This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Ankor Gopal never expected to return home to Kentucky. After college, he landed a job as a strategy and information technology consultant for Accenture in Chicago, where he thought he'd build his career. 6 years later, Ankor jumped ship, returned to Kentucky, and began working on a startup in his parents' basement. That first business didn't work out, but Ankor's next two companies did. The larger one, Louisville technology solutions provider Interapt, has grown to more than 300 employees. And in solving its own tech worker recruitment problems, developed an expanding apprenticeship program that helps other companies build their tech workforces as well. Ankor, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thank you, Kathleen. Happy to be here.
Your parents immigrated to the U.S. from India and chose to live in Owensboro, Kentucky. Why?
Well, my dad grew up in New Delhi, India, and always dreamed of coming to America and got a chance to. When he got accepted to his master's in petroleum engineering at the University of Missouri, Rolla. From there, he was recruited by a number of companies in Texas and California, and also a large company in a small city, Owensboro, Kentucky. He wanted to see the real America, and so he accepted the job offer there, went back to India, married my mom, and we built a family there for almost 35 years. So it was a great place to grow up.
How many people live in Owensboro?
About 65,000 at the time, yeah.
Wow. After college, you moved to the big city. You got the job at Accenture, where you got a lot of job offers as you were working at Accenture. None of them seemed quite right. What made you realize the job you really wanted was to be an entrepreneur?
Yeah, well, growing up, you know, you don't really take a class for entrepreneurship. The only exposure I had was with Junior Achievement, and I really loved that. It helped me. It was the first time I got exposed to business, and it really always was in the back of my mind that one day I wanted to do it. After joining Accenture, I had a lot of great experiences, got to work in a number of different industries. I worked on, you know, in their strategy and IT effectiveness group, and it was really exciting to kind of be in the cusp of those projects and, you know, an e-commerce project back in the early 2000s. However, you know, kind of when you work for a large firm that it's a very big sort of machine. It's a big cruise ship. It doesn't move as quickly as I felt I could move at. And so eventually I thought that my career there was, while I had a great experience, but I had to move on to something better. And kind of that's what started the seed of starting my own company, becoming an entrepreneur.
So you wanted to move fast and make big decisions.
I'd say yes. That's probably a fair assessment.
So you took the leap. You were 30, broke, single, and working out of your parents' basement in Owensboro, Kentucky, on your first startup, Revassist. Tell us about what it did and why you ended up shutting it down.
Yeah, so my mother's a physician, and I knew she had a lot of difficulty collecting money from insurance providers, which, of course, led to me trying to use technology to solve it for her. So Revassist was revenue cycle management for physicians and hospitals. We thought we would get a lot of interest and sell, you know, to clients every 3, 6, and 9 months. And we had a model around that. But essentially what happened was we didn't get our first client till month 14. It's a very difficult industry to sell into. And anyone who knows healthcare can empathize with that. But, we did good work. We were able to build some, you know, good reputation. But eventually we decided that, this wasn't a business that was going to be long-term sustainable. EMRs were becoming more prevalent. They were going to help with the revenue cycle management stream. It became a bit of a commoditized business. So we decided to kind of sell our solution to our four biggest customers and ramp it down. And then I then started to transition to my next company idea, which was in more my passion, which was innovative and cutting edge technologies.
After you wound down Revassist, you started another company called Agent 511 that has software for sending text messages. And that company is still going on. But by listening to customers, you realized there was a lot of demand for and money to be made in building apps, and Interapt was born. You don't lack for ideas, do you?
I don't, but I'm very good and disciplined about not following the shiny new toy. much better now than I probably was 10 years ago. But yeah, I have plenty of ideas, but that's part of the idea that of being an entrepreneur. You know, you can have plenty of ideas, but ideas are only worth 5% of any business. It's execution that matters. So when you look at what it does take, what you really need to dedicate, what you really need to do and solve for to really build a successful and sustainable business, you've got to be able to focus and be able to, you know, take the long run at that sort of idea, not just kind of do it, address it for a couple of months, and then think it's going to be fine on its own.
Yeah, live with it, as it were, right? Mm-hmm. 3 years into Interapt, you realize mobile app development leads to a lot of other services, and you could provide like cloud engineering, user experience design. You went to hire more tech workers so you could expand into those areas, and you struggled to find them. What'd you do about it?
Yeah, you know, we had a great problem. We were doing wonderful work for a lot of major Fortune 250 clients, and they asked us to do more. And I said, great, let's just go hire another 50 engineers and get them to relocate to Louisville or to Kentucky. We found it was hard to recruit people from Boulder, Colorado, San Francisco, Atlanta, New York. So we instead took an entrepreneurial sort of approach to it and said, you know what, I'm tired of trying to convince people to be here. I'm just going to find people who already like living here, invest in them and upskill them so they can join our company and our projects. So that essentially led to me creating my own sort of training academy, if you will, or internal apprenticeship, which we taught people, you know, kind of in, you know, a couple of 2 to 3 months of really intense learning, some on the job training, and we got them deployed on clients quickly. So that model worked, and that not only worked in our own backyard in Louisville, but we were asked to go do that in places that needed jobs the most: Eastern Kentucky, West Atlanta, South Chicago, Dallas, San Antonio, and we've expanded that model quite a bit ever since.
Well, and just to be clear, you know, there are these coding boot camps that last maybe 3 months, but you've turned this into an apprenticeship program where you pay the people to learn these new skills, right?
You know, there's a lot of buzz around the boot camp market back in 2015, 16, 17, and still is. The problem is that not all boot camps are created equal. We looked at the curriculum because we come from an IT services standpoint. We know what it takes to work in a dev shop and what it requires. And we saw, frankly, by 85, 90% of them just weren't cutting it. Their curriculum was too simplified. On a scale of 1 to 10. They were putting out twos. I needed someone to be at least a 4.5 before I could get a senior engineer to give them the attention they may need to get them to the next level. And that's where we created the sort of one of the first IT apprenticeships in the country, because we took junior people, we created a very intense curriculum in partnership with General Assembly, who we saw their curriculum was excellent. They were very good in terms of stair-stepping a young engineer developer or an aspiring engineer developer to get through a bootcamp and be really ready to join a dev team. So, and in that 1 year of apprenticeship, I had to make sure that my senior devs weren't bored or they were not being saddled with someone that they felt was dragging them down. So we had to really make sure the person was driven and had the aptitude to continue to learn their own. And that's what we've done really well on. So, and to kind of look at our training and bootcamp model, how we've kind of evolved it to the apprenticeship side, we like to say that our training with General Assembly is like cramming 3 years of computer science into 3 months. And then cramming, you know, 3 years of work experience into 1 year through our apprenticeship. So after 15 months, only then do we feel someone is really market ready and can say, hey, I can join a dev team on my own. But a lot of the boot camps just didn't cut it around where we were. And that was just based on we were in an industry that demanded excellence and a lot higher a quality than we were getting in some of those boot camps.
So one of the interesting things about that, you know, that apprenticeship part that you're expanding into other cities is now about 30% of your business, is the way you continuously have listened to customers and changed your business and added to it as you listen to them.
You're absolutely right. I mean, because we were doing this for software development and maybe, you know, and maybe DevOps, we've now expanded that because our customers said, you know what else we need? What? Cybersecurity. Great. Cloud. No problem. Data science, we can do that. Even COBOL, we're working with a couple of large banks on mainframe type stuff that I didn't think we'd ever do. But however, when we've learned, what we've learned is that what we're extremely good at is, and on top of our delivery of services, is we're good at assessing talent. We're good at training them quickly, and we're also good at employing them efficiently and effectively. So those are the three parts of our secret sauce that I think we're better at than most anyone in the country. And that also listening to our customers and seeing what other pain points do you have that we may be able to solve. That's what the beauty of the entrepreneurial approach and being nimble for large, sort of especially enterprise clients that, you know, you're already entrenched with, they already trust you, you already have built a reputation inside of the business with them. And then they're asking you to do more with them. That's a great way that we've been able to grow and really expand our footprint around the country.
So you've got more than 300 employees. What's your goal? What do you want to grow to?
10,000 employees has always been the North Star. We believe we're well on our way. We are in the middle of a tech talent problem in America. Tech talent crisis in America. We also have an equity crisis in America. And fortunately, we were able to go find people in communities that people typically don't look at. Veterans, people of color, women, people returning to the workforce, even community college and sort of like, you know, smaller college areas where in cities that aren't typically hotbeds of IT recruitment. So we feel very proud about the people that we're serving. And I think that, you know, that's kind of part of what differentiates us from a lot of other companies. We do things a little differently. We do them a little bit brashly, but also with mission in mind. So we've got POs and we've got partnerships that could get us, you know, we probably at least 15 to 20% of the way there in the next 12 to 24 months. So we don't think that 10,000 jobs is far-fetched. It's in fact, you know, what we talk about almost every day.
Well, it's fortunate for a lot of people you left your corporate job, and it's going to be fun watching you grow. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Michael Chambers grew up in his family's commercial beekeeping business, observing the insects' unique attributes, their ability to fly long distances, and to communicate with special dances, inspired him to study biotechnology at North Dakota State University. By the time he was a sophomore there, Michael had figured out a way to have his own federally funded research lab. By the time he graduated, he and a friend had started a company. That company, Fargo-based Aldevron, is a leading provider of plasmid DNA, gene-cutting enzymes, and other products. It was acquired by medical equipment maker Danaher in 2021 for about $9.6 billion in cash. Michael, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Kathleen, thank you for that kind introduction. It's so nice to be here and so nice to talk about Aldevron and entrepreneurism in the Midwest.
You grew up observing the behavior of bees. Tell us why you found them so interesting.
Well, I could speak for a long time on that. My parents are beekeepers and my grandparents are beekeepers. We ran about close to 10,000 colonies. So it's a pretty large operation. And the beehive is such an incredible community of many thousands of bees that fly thousands of miles. And they each produce only a relatively small amount of honey, but you know they work very, very hard to do that. And as you mentioned, there are just incredible communication. Or there is incredible communication between the bees in terms of how the queen communicates and shares information about where flowers are and where pollen is and where nectar is, and you know how workers interpret those instructions. Each of these bees can fly up to like 6 miles, which is just incredible if you think about this little bee going 6 human miles. And they bring back a very small amount of nectar, and all this is choreographed in very complex ways.
Come on, tell us about the waggle dance.
You know, that's an incredible, that language, the bees' language, is really second in complexity only to ours. Carl von Frisch did a lot of research in the 1920s, and he would eventually win the Nobel Prize the year I was born, 1974. For interpreting that dance. And the honeybee and that waggle dance still inspires Aldebaran today to, you know, we look for that to improve continuously, build networks to serve our clients, to serve each other. And even the Aldebaran logo, if you look at it, it has an embedded honeycomb. If you spend some time on our campus, you'll see tributes to that beekeeping heritage all over the place, from the way our buildings are designed, to the carpet, to many other things. So it remains an important inspiration to us to this day.
Who knew? Many would-be researchers have been thwarted by the difficulty of getting federal funding. How did you manage to get your own federally funded lab 2 years into college?
Yeah, so that's a really, really great question. And I think, you know, there are so many great schools in the United States and around the world. And a lot of attention goes to, you know, the MITs and Harvards and Stanfords, but there are so many advantages to the land grant institutions like North Dakota State University, where I went to school. And one of those advantages is the ability to really sort of get ahead and skip the line if you want to work hard, you know. And from the time I was a freshman, I was really able to do independent research. I loved laboratory work. I had a great mentor. I learned sort of the exhilaration of looking through a microscope and seeing something that has never been witnessed before, you know, in history. And, you know, that happens every day. And I think that sort of inspired me to really want to be more independent and start researching. At that time in the mid to late 90s, gene therapy and nucleic acid technology and fields around biology were still pretty new. Actually, I should say they had recently been reduced to practice. They'd been conceptualized for a long time. But, you know, I really wanted to work in this area, and I was able to find a special, there's a sort of class of grant, I think it still might be around, called an EBSCOR grant that is dedicated to Midwestern land grant institutions like North Dakota State University. Came up with some ideas, spent a lot of time in the library and researching and put a grant package together, and I guess to my surprise, it was ultimately funded. And it wasn't much by today's standards. I mean, it was probably $10,000 a year or something like that. By the time, that was a lot of money. And I had the grant, and the chair of the department was able to find me a lab, and that's how we got started.
But, you know, we're talking about plasmid DNA. Plasmid's a small DNA molecule found in bacteria and other cells that's often used to manipulate genes in the lab. So you realized when you were in college and when you had this lab that there was a need for high-quality plasmid. How did you turn that insight into a company that now has the world's largest plasmid DNA manufacturing facility?
Well, if we rerun the clock, I mean, I had the insight because I needed plasmids. That's, I mean, I was in the lab, and I couldn't do research because I didn't have the plasmid DNA that I needed. And so we developed ways to sort of work through that. I had built my own fermenter in the lab. One fermenter actually blew up once, and it was messy. It wasn't dangerous, but it was stinky and messy, and there's bacteria all over the place. And you know, I realized that there are probably a lot of people around the molecular biology world that were going through the same thing. And I was reading a lot. I spent a lot of time going through journals, just doing a lot of research. And you could sort of see where the technology was leading. The technology was very brand new, but you could tell therapies were going to be developed from this. And you could do the math backwards. I mean, we knew how much DNA was needed for a particular therapy, and there was no way to make that DNA right now. And we realized that this was going to be rate limiting to the field. And it wasn't just nucleic acids, it was other, you know, proteins and enzymes and other things that we really needed to thrive. And just as you know, steel is needed to build modern cities, you know, standard parts are needed to advance biology and medicine. And I think that's sort of how we came to that realization. And so, yeah, you know, towards the middle of my junior year, I'm from North Dakota originally, but I met one of my best friends in the world, John Ballantyne, who was from New Zealand. And he was a grad student. And he and I started working together, and we developed large-scale fermentation technology. started working on not only how to make material, make standardized plasmids and other nucleic acids, but we designed analytics around these and, you know, how to produce this material. And that led to Aldevron. John was our chief scientific officer. He just retired from Aldevron after many years. Now we're working together on a lot of other companies. That's very exciting.
So Michael, when you started Aldevron, when you were still in college, how did you get your first order? How'd that work?
It's really interesting. So we had a lab, we were doing a lot of research in a field called DNA vaccines and realized that we could make large quantities of DNA. We realized there were probably other people in the world that needed the same thing that we did. And so at the time there was no Facebook, there was no LinkedIn or anything like that, but there were message boards. And I sent a message to what was called the DNA vaccine web, and just saying, my name is Michael Chambers. I'm at North Dakota State, starting a company. If you need DNA, please let me know. I'd be happy to help you out. And I was expecting maybe 3 or 4 responses. The next day I had 87 responses from around the world of people that wanted DNA. And from that came our first clients. And I remember getting that first purchase order. I remember very well our you know, the first 5 clients, the exact amounts of that we made for them and the invoices. But what I really remember is just being struck by this level of trust that our clients would place in us, that they would pay us money to make something for them and to be part of their research program. And that spirit is still within Aldevron today, no matter who you talk to, whether it's a CEO or a technician or the custodian or a salesperson, they all recognize that. And I'm very proud to say that started in day one. And one other thing I will say, some of those people that we met back in 1998 are still people that we work with today in the industry.
Wow, that says something too. So I just want to clarify, you're in Fargo, North Dakota. You've figured out that there's going to be this big need for plasmid DNA. Fargo has a population of about 125,000 people. You start a company. How do you find and recruit employees and executives in Fargo?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's something I'm very proud of. And Aldevron has this incredible combination of homegrown talent and people that have joined us from the outside and from other companies, from other industries, and certainly from other regions. And many executives at Aldevron, I'd say most executives at Aldevron, went to North Dakota State University or one of the other local colleges, University of North Dakota, Minnesota State University, Moorhead. For instance, I went to school with Michelle Berg, and she now runs the largest business unit at Aldevron, our DNA business unit, where most of the people work for. Tom Foti also runs a business, our other business unit. He was a North Dakota State University graduate. He's in Madison, oversees about 100 people there. And, you know, these are the presidents, and their reports are also in the SU graduates. But I'm really proud to say that we have this culture, and we built this culture that can rapidly change and grow. And the people here are so dedicated to continuous improvement, and they know that needs, we need to be hungry for new ways and new knowledge. And so we brought in a lot of people, a lot of senior executives that have come from other industries that align with that mission. When I changed roles in 2020, I stepped down as a CEO. We wanted to hire our first professional CEO. We were able to recruit Kevin Ballinger, and he's probably the best example of the kind of person and the caliber of person we can recruit. I mean, he's Aldevron's first professional CEO, but before that, he had an incredible 25-year career at Boston Scientific, another company that we try to learn from and emulate. This is this great culture. And he came here and really helped take that ability of the company to meld the old and the new together in a seamless way to a whole new level. And he's just a good example of, you know, how we supplement this homegrown talent with people from the outside. And I think at the end of the day, it really comes down to the mission. Everybody here, everybody at Aldevron knows we're on a mission to serve patients. That's what this is all about, you know, is speeding these new genomic medicines to people who need them. And people who are passionate about that, regardless of whether they're, you know, internal and from Fargo or external, people who align with that mission align with Aldevron. And I think that's been sort of the hallmark of the company and how we combine those two cultures.
What are some of the biggest challenges you faced in trying to build this company?
You know, we grew very, very fast. And there are I mean, it's been a rocket ship for pretty much the last 15 years, I think. And I think maintaining the culture and trust throughout the organization during those high growth periods have that's certainly been a challenge. And there have certainly been times when we struggle with morale, and we address that and try to solve for that and try to include everybody in that equation. Again, to get through those, it's important we always come back to that mission, the opportunity to innovate, the opportunity to serve each other and our clients, and work, really honor that the trust that our clients have placed in us by paying us to make things for them. So that, I think that's probably been the hardest part, is just maintaining that culture, hiring the right people, building the right people, certainly developing the technology. The field's expanding very, very fast. We're part of that expansion and we help fuel that. So there's a symbiotic relationship between companies like Aldevron and the researchers that are developing these new technologies. So focusing on that, we're in this new era where we can actually program medicine. And if you think about that, it's just incredible. And, historically, going back to Hippocrates, we try different medicines and see how they work against different diseases. And it's sort of this random process, try and find what fits. But now, with digital biology and the ability to program RNA and DNA, we can make designer medicines for very specific indications. And yeah, people like the people that you mentioned are doing that. Carl June is another person. You're probably familiar with CAR T technology, the ability to actually take our own cells and turn those into living medicines. He's an inventor in that technology. Francis Arnold, so many people. We have the distinct privilege to work with.
You shifted from CEO to executive chairman. Will you stay involved with the company? What are your plans for the future?
I was executive chairman until we were purchased by Danaher, but now we don't have a board, so there's no need for a chairman. So my title, I guess, now is founding CEO, and I still work with Aldevron, and I'm very excited to see what Kevin is doing with the company. And my mission is really to support him however I can, and to support my colleagues and be involved with strategy. But outside of the company, we started a family office in 2017. And so through that mechanism, we've been investing in new biotech companies, throughout the world, really. And other entrepreneurs doing things. So those are the two hats I wear right now. But I'm very thankful and grateful for the opportunity to continue to be part of that Aldevron mission.
Well, Michael, it's amazing what you built, and it's going to be fun to watch what you do in coming years. Thanks so much for joining us on Midwest Moxie.
Thank you.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. Midwest Moxie was created by executive producer Audrey Nowakowski and me. Today's episode was produced by Ellie Ellis. Join us next Sunday at 7 p.m. to hear from more visionary Midwestern founders building innovative companies. That's right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.